Isi Bhaktivedanta Swami Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai, Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai, Namacharya Shri Haridas Thakur Ki Jai, Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to Shri Shri Guru and Gauranga, all glories to Shri Prabhupada. Right, the book was marked on verse 24. Is it verse 24 or 25? 25, good, okay, because that is the verse on Facebook. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam namaskritya naram chaiva narotamam devim sarasvatim vyasam tato jayam udirayat nasta praishva badreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavatritama shloke bhaktir bhavati nashtiki. We're reading this morning from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, the status quo, Chapter 5. This is Chapter 5, Vidura talks with Maitreya, text number 25. Sava etasya sam drashtu. Sava etasya sam drashtu. Shakti sat asad atmika. Shakti sat asad atmika. Maya nama mahabhaga. Maya nama mahabhaga. Yaidam nirmame vibhu. Yaidam nirmame vibhu. Sava etasya samdrashtu. Shakti. Shakti sad asad atmika. Mayanama mahabhaga. Yairam nirmame vibhu. please chant. Sva etasya sandrashtu shakti sad asad atmika mayanama mahabhaga yaidam nirmevibhu. Sva etasya sandrashtu shakti sad asad atmika mayanama mahabhaga yaidam nirmamevibhu. Sava etasya samdrashtu shakti sad asad atmika mayanama mahabhaga yaedam nirmamevibhu. Thank you. Ladies, anybody? Sva etasya samdrashtu shakti sad asad atmika mayanama mahabhaga yaedam nirmamevibhu. Sva etasya samdrashtu etasya of the Lord, samdrashtu of the perfect seer, shakti energy, sat asad atmika, both the cause and the effect, mayanama, called by the name of Maya, mahabhaga, O fortunate one, yaya, by which, idam, this material world, nirmame, constructed, vibhu, the Almighty. Translation: the Lord is the seer, and the external energy which is seen works as both cause and effect in the cosmic manifestation. O greatly fortunate Vidura, this external energy is known as Maya, or illusion, and through her agency only is the entire material manifestation made possible. Purport. The material nature, known as Maya, is both the material and efficient cause of the cosmos. But in the background, the Lord is the consciousness for all activities. As in the individual body, the consciousness is the source of all energies of the body, so the supreme consciousness of the Lord is the source of all energies in material nature. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita as follows: Maya Dyakshena Prakriti Suyate Sacharacharam Hetu Nanena Konteya Jagat Viparivartite. Throughout all the energies of material nature, there is the hand of the Supreme Lord as the final superintendent. Due to this supreme cause only, the activities of material nature appear planned and systematic, and all things regularly evolve. Om Angyane Timirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitamina Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobishtam Shtapitam Nena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Padamayam Tadati Svapadantitam Vancha Kalpaturvyasya Kripa Sindhubya Evacha Petitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasari Gaura Bhaktavrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hari Hari. So, good morning. Thank you all for coming here at New Ramen Reiti and online in Alachua and around the world. I just want to make a brief comment as to what Mukhya said about the class and being on the schedule and off the schedule and on the schedule. I normally tell Sri Gaurangi that I can give classes on Fridays because I typically don't start teaching until 10:30 on Fridays. So she knows that. But then my schedule for the second semester changed like 2 days ago. And I didn't just want to cancel because I know that it's like hard to find speakers, especially on short notice. And so if you're out there here in Alachua, please speak from the Bhagavatam. We need help. So I thought I'm not going to do that. And then Sri Gaurangi texted me and said, we may have a guest speaker. And I was like, oh, that works out well, because actually I may need to stop early is the point of this whole speech here. And but then it turns out they didn't have a guest speaker. So here I am speaking about the pastimes, the further pastimes of Vidura, who of course was an intimate relative of Krishna, very intimately related to Krishna by blood. And so the Bhagavatam is the story about great devotees of Krishna. And Vidura was not only a great devotee of Krishna, he was a relative of Krishna. Not all of Krishna's relatives played the parts of great devotees. Some of them were very inimical to Krishna. Just to put this into a little bit of context before getting into the details of the verse, in the beginning of the very end, I should say, of the second canto, King Parikshit asked Sukadeva Goswami quite abruptly, after Sukadeva Goswami narrated the creation of the material universe and the engineering of the things within the material universe by the hand, or the mind rather, of Lord Brahma, King Parikshit quite abruptly changes the subject and asks Sukadeva Goswami to narrate the pastimes of Vidura, who of course we know chastised Dhritarashtra, his brother, quite heavily, gave him the sauce, as it is said, and then left the castle to go on a pilgrimage. And along the way in the pilgrimage, he encountered Uddhava, and we've just finished a few weeks ago, since we do basically one verse a day, the narration of Uddhava, the conversation of Uddhava and Vidura. And basically the culmination of this conversation between Uddhava and Vidura was that Uddhava encouraged Vidura to go seek out Maitreya Muni and to inquire from him about, you know, the nature of reality and all that stuff. Vidura did that. He met Maitreya in Rishikesh, as is explained, or Haridwar, where the Ganges comes out of the proper Himalayas and onto the floodplains. And the first thing that Vidura did, of course, and this is a common sort of narrative vehicle within the Bhagavatam, is that the first thing that Vidura did when he met Maitreya is he asked Maitreya a whole bunch of questions, right? And I printed them out. I'm not going to go through all of them because I'm getting old and I can't see this as well as I used to. I'm sorry to say. In going through these questions, yeah, and the Bhagavatam narrates this is really one question after the next, one question after the next, one question after the next, over 10-15 verses here in the beginning of this chapter. And if you analyze the nature of these questions, actually, Vidura is asking Maitreya to narrate all of the 10 topics of the Bhagavatam. So we know that there are 10 topics mentioned in the Bhagavatam. There's Sarga, which is the creation of, which is the universal creation. And then there's Visarga, which is the creation within the material creation. So there's the creation of all of the material universes out of the skin pores of the Karna Dakshai Vishnu, his mystic slumber, inhalation, exhalation. You know, this is beyond any of our conceptions of photosynthesis or cellular respiration, the deep breathing of Mahavishnu. The deep breathing of Mahavishnu, of course, leads to the creation of innumerable material universes, And it may have been when Srila Prabhupada wrote Easy Journeys to Other Planets and revealed this concept to the world at large in English, that the idea of there being multiple universes or more than one universe may have been a bit foreign. Of course, this is now all the rage in modern theoretical physics and astronomy and these types of sciences, that it's pretty much an accepted fact that there are other universes besides the one that we are inhabiting. And even the one that we are inhabiting cannot really be defined all that well beyond our immediate purview here on Earth. As soon as we start getting into space, things start to become difficult to know for sure, one way or another. And so Sarga, and then there's Visarga. So once the material universes are created, there's what goes on inside the material universe to create stars and planets and asteroids and meteors and all of the different varieties of living entities that we find within the material universes, both subtle and gross, and their senses, working senses, and so on and so forth. Working senses, knowledge acquiring senses. This is Visarga, secondary creation. The Bhagavatam discusses topics of sthanam, the planetary systems, how things are arranged in the universe. It discusses the topic of poshanam, which is the protection of the Lord, how the Lord is protecting his various devotees. There's Utaya, the creative impulse, which is also the title of the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. There's descriptions of the periods of Manu. The science of God, which we see revealed throughout the Bhagavatam in the form of various forms of Sankhya that are described. There are major portions of this in the Bhagavatam in the third canto, later on in the third canto, as well as much of the 11th canto covers this matter. There's the Nirodha, which is the dissolution of the material universes. So the Bhagavatam speaks both about the creation of the universe and the dissolution of the material universe. It talks about Mukti, how do we get out of the material universe? And it talks about Ashraya, which is the supreme shelter. Because getting out of the material universe is not the goal of the living entity. We are not seeking liberation. And this is one of the many aspects that sets the practice of Krishna consciousness in a non-sectarian way, apart from many of the other choices of religious traditions we have out there. So we are not really interested in liberation, or as, to put this in the context of Abrahamic religious traditions, we're not really trying to be saved, right? We're not really trying to be saved. We are trying to engage in a loving relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the ashraya for everything in the universe. And so this is all to say, this is a brief little synopsis of the 10 topics of the Bhagavatam, is simply to say that the questions Vidura asked Maitreya, actually he's asking Maitreya to narrate all of this. So he's basically asking Maitreya through a series of more specific questions, please narrate to me the Srimad Bhagavatam. Please tell the Bhagavatam to me. And I'm thinking this so as a, you know, for something, all these questions, and this always reminds me of the famous purport in the first canto of the Bhagavatam, where Prabhupada just writes questions and answers, questions and answers, questions and answers. The birds are questioning and answering, the trees are questioning and answering. So what is our life if we are not questioning and answering? And so I'm reading this, preparing for the class, and the question that comes first to my mind is, why did Uddhava send Vidura to Maitreya? Right? Isn't Uddhava like the most qualified, confidential devotee of Krishna? He's taken on Krishna's bodily appearance. When Krishna needed to send a message to the gopis in Vrindavan, which is like the most intimate thing that Krishna does, is this little tiny bit of reciprocation with the gopis in absentia, after the gopis have been catatonic for God knows how long, he sends Uddhava just with a little bit of a message. Why would Vidura need to go take instruction from somebody else? Yeah. And there's a Sanskrit term for this. Let me see if I get this right. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I think it's called Mayada Vikarika. Did I get that right? This is why I asked somebody for a pen earlier, because I needed one. No. Vatikrama, thank you. Yes. Yes. So this is the etiquette of choosing a guru. So Vidura was an old man by the time he stormed out of the castle. He was the younger brother of Dhritarashtra, and he was criticizing Dhritarashtra for being an old man and hanging on to power. So they were close in age, already kind of old, and Uddhava, having attained the Sairupya Mukti of the Lord, appeared ever useful and fresh as Krishna. And also by the lineage within the entire Yadu dynasty, Uddhava was much younger than Vidura. And so he didn't feel qualified to instruct his uncle, some elderly previous generation relative. And so he sent him to Maitreya, and I'm thinking, I was discussing this with a friend of mine in preparation for the class, the pastimes of the Lord, and I'm thinking, but Maitreya is just like some mystic yogi. Like, why would you want to go? Like, just, okay, mystic yogi, cool, whatever. But I would have insisted, if I was Vidura, I would have insisted, no, I want to hear more from Uddhava. But Uddhava sent Vidura to speak to Maitreya out of etiquette, but it wasn't that Maitreya was unqualified at all. In fact, Maitreya had many qualifications to be speaking the Bhagavatam and to be a qualified person from whom to hear the Bhagavatam. So we cannot just hear the Bhagavatam from anybody. The person who is speaking the Bhagavatam needs to have some basic qualifications. And the first qualification that they need to have is that they need to have heard the Bhagavatam themselves from an authorized source. So Maitreya was the son of Parashar Muni, who of course is, the student, the disciple of Parashar Muni, who is the father of Vyasadeva. So already there's, he's already in very good association right there. This is recorded, Srila Prabhupada writes this in the purport to Canto 3, verse 25, chapter 25, verse 4. Prabhupada writes in the purport that Maitreya was a disciple of Parashar, and I'm sure there's many ways to cross-reference this in other Vedic literatures, but we get it straight from Srila Prabhupada. It's described in the Shanti Parva of the Mahabharata that Maitreya was also present when Bhishma Dev was holding his discourse on the bed of arrows. So Bhishma laid down some serious knowledge when he was lying on the bed of arrows, and Maitreya Muni was present when that happened. In the Vana Parva of the Mahabharata, it's explained that when the Pandavas first went into exile, Maitreya Muni was like on the edge of the forest to see them going into exile, and he did not think this was very good. And he went to the court of the Kauravas to plead for mercy on behalf of the Pandavas. And I'm not that good at remembering the details of all these pastimes, but Dhritarashtra was actually favorably inclined to the council of Maitreya Muni. But Duryodhana was not, and he seemed even disinterested from hearing from him, it's explained in the Mahabharata. And so while Maitreya was pleading on behalf or giving testimony on behalf of the Pandavas, he was tapping on his thigh like a bored high school student, which I get a lot of. So sorry for the analogy, but he was like, you know how people do when they're bored, like, okay, get on with it, buddy, and they're just like tapping their fingers. And Duryodhana was doing that on his thigh. While Maitreya was trying to plead on behalf of the Pandavas. And so Maitreya cursed Duryodhana. He said, Bhima will break that thigh, and it will be your demise. And sure enough, smash, ka-chow, as the kids said. So Maitreya was a friend of the Pandavas, and he was a friend of Krishna. He was an ally of Krishna. So he had many different qualifications, but the first and foremost qualification he had was that his discipleship of Parashar Muni. And so there's a lineage here that's explained a little bit later in the Bhagavatam, in the eighth chapter of the third canto. The lineage of Maitreya Muni is described as starting with Shankarshan, who's present here before us as the Lord Balaram, the guru of the entire universe. So it's a pretty good place to start, I'd say. Shankarshan instructed Sanat Kumar. And so we know one of the four main Vaishnava lineages comes through the four Kumaras and Sanat Kumar. So Maitreya is representing that lineage here in the Bhagavatam we are reading in a different lineage. So there's some interdisciplinary study going on. And we know that this interdisciplinary study was supported and upheld and promoted by our recent acharya, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, who, when he founded the Yoga Pit, although he himself is a representative of the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya, he represented all four of the Vaishnava Sampradayas in the temple of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that he installed at the Yoga Pit. And so, Shankarshan instructed Sanat Kumar. Sanat Kumar instructed Sankhyayana Muni. I do not know who that is, I apologize. But Sankhyayana Muni, according to the verdict of the Bhagavatam, so I don't know, but I am able to repeat what I've read He instructed Parashar Muni, who is the guru of Maitreya Muni. So Maitreya Muni, despite not being the most intimate friend of Lord Krishna, completely qualified to be speaking the Bhagavatam. And this is, I think, an important instruction for disciples and aspiring disciples in the modern era, is that, and Srila Prabhupada spoke this in a Vyasa Puja offering to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, that although the principle of guru is one, the guru is the person who is lifting us up out of the material world, there are differences in the way the guru appears in the world, and it's important for us to have a relationship with our guru, and and relationships are based on personalities, right? And so these personalities, for the relationship to be healthy, the personalities need to mesh somehow in a favorable way. So Uddhava was not the right person for Vidura. And Uddhava, in his position of spiritual authority, sent him to the right person because he was humble and he understood the etiquette and he had Vidura's best interest in mind. His interest wasn't me to be the big preacher here or to be the big instructor. It was, what does this potential disciple or this aspiring devotee, what do they need most? And how can I facilitate that? And in this particular case, it meant sending him to somebody else. And so I thought that was a little bit instructive. And so here we are. Vidura asked Maitreya all these questions. And here in the verse, the present verse and the last few verses, Maitreya begins to answer the questions one by one. And he begins again with the beginning of the Bhagavatam Sarga and the elemental creation. But this time he has it mixed in a little bit with Ashraya. He has it mixed in a little bit with who is the personality in the background of the whole thing. And so we read here that, first of all, the Lord is the seer. And by seer in this context, as is explained very briefly in the purport, it means that Krishna, in the same way that we are conscious of what's going on in our body, Krishna is conscious of what's going on everywhere. Right, so we get a little indigestion, we feel what's going on in our body. You know, our back is stiff, our shoulders aren't stiff. So we're kind of conscious of what's going on in our body. And we can train this consciousness also. We can do different types of mystic meditations, we can go in, we can withdraw our consciousness, we can put our consciousness in our big toe, we can follow our breath. You know, there's many ways we can train our consciousness to be fully present in our body. But Srila Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavad Gita that we can be conscious of our own body, but we cannot really be conscious of other people's bodies. You know, maybe to a limited extent, we all have a little bit of psychic ability. Sometimes we can hear what the person next to us is thinking. You know, if somebody's talking about us over in the next county, the hairs on the back of our neck might stand up like this. But we don't really know, right? Sometimes I pretend that I can hear what the kids are thinking because it scares them. They can see it on their face that they just said something they shouldn't. And I can't really hear what they said, but I pretend that I can hear what they said. So they get a little scared. But we can do that to a limited extent, but we can't really do that. But Krishna is the seer. Krishna hears and sees everything that is going on all the time, everywhere, both within and without the material creation. That is one of the definitions of God, right? That is part of the job qualification for being God, right? So Prabhupada also writes in the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita that there's a difference between the idea of God and the idea of the Supreme Person. So God is like a job that Krishna has. And Krishna is so wonderful and so unlimited that he accomplishes this job without really doing anything. But it's still his job. And so if you want to assume that job, if anybody out there wants to assume the position of God, you had better be able to see and hear everything that is going on everywhere, all the time, since time immemorial. There you go. There you have it. And not just with your eyes and ears, also. We know that Krishna is angani yasya sakalendriya vitrimantri, which means he can accomplish that task with any one of his senses. So he doesn't even need to look at us with his eyes. He can look at us with his sense of smell. That's how wonderful Krishna is. So if you are going to claim to be God, you'd better be able to pull that off. So Krishna, the Lord is the seer, and the external energy which is seen. So what is Krishna seeing? He's seeing that which is manifested outside of him. Of course, we also know that anything that is manifested outside of Krishna is also Krishna. Where did that energy come from? But the external energy which is seen works as both the cause and the effect in the cosmic manifestation. That means all of the various permutations of things we see going on in the material world, and there's an unlimited number of them, even right here in the backyard. I mean, just in the soil that these beautiful flowers are growing out of, there are whole universes of causes and effects going on. But that's all coming from the external energy. So the external energy is the cause of all of that, and it's also the effect. So it's what's making it happen, and it is also what is happening. And this is a very detailed metaphysical description of how the material world works. And so this is a little bit sarga, this is how the world is created. But it's also the ashraya, it's also in whom does all of this rest. So that this external energy is known as maya, or illusion. And through her agency only is the entire material manifestation made possible. Why is it an illusion? It's an illusion because we think it is separate from Krishna. We think it is happening separately from Krishna. But it's not. And here in the purport, or here in this translation of verse 9:10 from the Bhagavad Gita, maya yakshena prakriti suyate sacharacharam hetu nanena kunteya jagatvi parivartite. In the Bhagavad Gita itself, Srila Prabhupada translates this verse a little bit differently, but here he writes that throughout all the energies of material nature, there is the hand of the Supreme Lord as the final superintendent. So Krishna has the final say, even though he may not be directly involved in every minuscule permutation that's going on here. He's the final superintendent. And due to this supreme cause only, the activities of material nature appear planned and systematic. They appear planned and systematic. There are laws for how material nature works. It looks as though there's a plan, right? You can't deny that. We have, in science, there are things called constants, which are numbers that are put into mathematical equations to make the equation work. The most famous one is the constant of universal gravitation, which is a very small number, and you plug an extremely small number. It's like 10 to the negative, big negative 18 or something. I can't remember exactly, but that's a decimal point with 17 zeros and a number at the end of it. That's the magnitude of the universal gravitational constant. Don't quote me on that, folks listening at home. I may have gotten the number wrong. But it's a very small number, is the point. And this number was experimentally determined nearly 100 years after Isaac Newton predicted it. So Isaac Newton came up with this equation that describes how things move based on the action of gravity, which we can't deny that there's something that is gravity in the world. The first thing that anybody with intelligence, and if you don't think this doesn't mean that you have intelligence, but if you are observing the scientific method and observing the world around you, the first thing you do when you wake up in the morning should be to ask yourself, why am I stuck to the ground? And you're stuck to the ground because of gravity. So everybody knows they're stuck to the ground. That's like the one thing we can really claim with certainty that we know. I'm stuck to this ground. And the older I get, the more stuck I appear to be. You used to be able to jump so high in the air, skiing off cliffs, trampolines, you name it. Now, more stuck to the ground. So gravity is winning. But what is this gravity? So we've studied this gravity, and Isaac Newton came up with this idea that gravity is the force of attraction between two objects that have mass, and there's a number, the constant of universal gravitation, that regulates that attraction, that defines what that attraction is. And we can claim, as devotees we often do, that the scientists don't really know what they're talking about. And it is a fact that scientists do not know what gravity is. We think it might be a force, but it's not really a force. It doesn't really behave like other forces. But we are able to control it, right? We are able to control it. You've been in an airplane before. Yeah. So airplanes are far and away the safest modes of travel. Your statistical likelihood of being injured in an airplane accident is way lower than any other form of travel you can think of. Because we've mastered the control of gravity within our little sphere here. We can take the plane off, we can land the plane, helicopters, all kinds of planes. Now we've got drones, They're replacing fireworks shows with drones, like drones lighting up in the sky, making super beautiful images. So we're very good with gravity because we understand this one number. So the universe appears planned and systematic. And that plan and that system is available to us through careful study, but it's an illusion to think that it appears planned and systematic, but there wasn't a planner. You know, how do you have a plan without a planner? So this is where the scientists go off the track, right? At least that's the popular narrative. Most scientists, I've read some statistical studies that will show that the proportion of atheists within the scientific community is higher than it is in non-scientific populations, but it's still quite low. It's still quite low. Maybe in the regular secular population, maybe there might be, the last statistics I read said there are maybe 13% of people who are just like declared atheists. There is no God. Right? God does not exist. That's a little different than an agnostic person who says, I don't really know, we can't really know. That's agnostic, I don't know. Gnosis comes from the Greek word knowledge. Gnosis is the Greek word knowledge, and agnostic means not knowing. It's different than atheist, that means there is no God. And the percentage of people in the population that really devoutly believe there is no God is relatively low, maybe 1 in 10. Amongst the scientist community, it might be double that, but that's still fully 80% of scientists polled in this study that I read a couple years ago. And it was a bona fide study, at least a well-done study, but it's outdated now. Still, 80% of scientists do believe in something. There's got to be something. Because that's what the evidence points to, as we read in this report. It appears planned and systematic, and all things regularly evolve. So what that means is that within those laws in which this material world operates, there is plenty of room for change, right? And that change comes about due to the free will of the living entity. So when the living entity begins to interact with matter, matter starts to evolve into all kinds of different permutations, and we get, you name it. I mean, anything you can think of exists somewhere in this universe. The living entities are sarvagata. Right? This is explained in the Bhagavad Gita. Living entities are sarva-gata, which means that they are everywhere. And I often use the example of before the early 1950s, we as humans, we as a species on this planet, did not know that anything lived in the oceans below a depth of about 100 meters, because that's the depth that light penetrates. And, if there's no light, there's no producer level of ecosystems. So the bottom rung of what's called a trophic pyramid, which is how energy moves through ecosystems in the world, are always plants. Because plants are autotrophs. They make their own food. They just stand out there in the sunlight feasting, right? All these plants out here, what are they doing all day? They're just eating. They never get indigestion. They never run out of food. They don't have to wait in line for the prasadam. They just have to stand there. And they're eating. And so they're the first level of biological productivity in an ecosystem. But because they're eating the light, it was believed that the light doesn't shine in the oceans, there's nothing living. But with advances in submarine technology, and we began to explore the oceans in more depth, we now know that there are living entities all the way down to the very deepest parts of the ocean, in the Challenger Deep, something like, 8 miles below the surface of the water. I'm sorry to use miles. I'm breaking my own vow to convert Americans to the metric system. Anyway, 12,000 meters. So what changed? Our ability to perceive increased with the advent of submarine technology, but those living entities have been there the whole time, right? They have bodies that are adapted to that environment. And so in the same way there are bodies that are adapted to living in nuclear furnaces like stars. Surya, right? It's a person who's living inside of the sun. And we perceive the body of the sun as this great nuclear furnace, but there's a person in there that is operating that furnace, whose body appears to us as fire, but is actually an intelligent, highly empowered living entity, the sun god. It's the same with this earth. We see this little stretch of land here in North Florida, our sandy soil, and all that good stuff, the water, But this earth is a person, Bhumi, Gaia, right? It's a singular living entity. And just like we are singular living entities whose body is maintaining so many millions and billions and trillions of other single cell living entities. So like just in your gut, just in your digestive tract, there is a whole Campbell's soup can full of bacteria. And every one of those bacteria is its own living entity. And every one of those bacteria has inside of itself mitochondria, which is feeding the bacteria. It's making energy for the bacteria. And every one of those mitochondria has its own DNA. It's its own living entity within every cell of your body. And so we are giving support. We are the ashraya for so many living entities that are trying to evolve their way back to Krishna. And we can support that by eating prasadam, by exercising, by being healthy, stuff like that. And so the earth is the same thing. You know, we are living on the body of the earth. And we are living off the body of the earth. Therefore, the earth is one of our seven mothers. I'll take questions in 2 minutes. Oh, you're just fixing it. You want to ask a question? Yeah. Okay. 5 minutes. Yeah. Yes. So, it appears systematic and all things are evolving. But the illusion is that we think we are acting in this world independently from Krishna. So I think, actually, I'll take that as Krishna's intervention. I will stop there. Like I said, I do need to leave a little bit early. So thank you very much for your time. So just to wrap it up. So Vidura asked Maitreya a whole bunch of questions, and we're just at the beginning of Maitreya answering those questions. And really what Maitreya is going to do is he's going to give his version of the Bhagavad Purana, the version of the Bhagavad Purana that he heard through the Kumara Sampradaya. He is going to instruct Vidura in this. And this is contained in our Bhagavatam here. The Bhagavatam is a mythic history. And when I say mythic history, I mean myth with a big capital M. And the word doesn't speak at all to the truthfulness or the untruthfulness or the historical reality of any of this. The myth with a capital M speaks to how we attain knowledge of the world that we live in. This is the fundamental quest of human life, is who are we? And where did we come from? And what am I doing here? And why do I have to pay taxes? Right? These types of questions. Why does my back hurt in the morning? Why am I forced to suffer? This is what Sanatana Goswami asked Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, or commented Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. When people claim I'm so learned, but I do not know who I am, or why I have to suffer in this world. And so myth, in a global religious context, is how we answer these questions for ourselves, how we describe these things. And it's often taken to myth to mean something false, or a story, or a narrative that we make up to make ourselves feel good at night or whatever, but that's not what it is. The evidence for the reality of this myth is not empirical. It can't be discerned by testing. It's given to us by Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, right? And so we have to have this implicit faith that Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra is the guiding light in our world. And these other forms of knowledge, they may be helpful, you know. They may be helpful. You know, I got in my car this morning and drove here. I used the internet to research all this. You know, before I would have to sit in a monastery for 60 years copying this all down by hand, right? And I would be expected to remember all of it the first time I copied it down. And that is not going to happen, right? So we do use this technology to aid our lives, and this technology arises out of scientific knowledge, but more importantly, it arises out of the pursuit to control material nature. You know, we use our science to try to dominate the world around us. And in the rare occasions that we use our science to try to elevate the world around us, and this is a growing field of science, environmental technology and whatnot, why are we doing that? Are we doing that to glorify Krishna? Not really, when I speak about the masses of people. We're doing this to try to further our sense gratification, right? We don't want to create, you know, mass climate refugee situations here or disasters. And this is happening now. I don't mean to get too cynical, but we do. This is another topic of the Bhagavatam, is Nirodha, the dissolution of the universe. And the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam is called the Age of Deterioration. So I'm not being cynical. This is spoken of in the Bhagavatam. And this is because we are an illusion. This is because we mistake the operation of the material energy to, number one, be independent of the control of the Supreme Lord, and number two, to be meant for our own sense gratification. This world is not meant here for us to exploit, right? We are trapped here because of our exploitative mentality. So that's the illusion. And we will hear more about this as Maitreya speaks further to Vidura in the coming verses and chapters. So thank you very much. Hare Krishna. I'll take some questions from the east side of the room. North side of, north-ish side of the room, yeah.
So there's innumerous living entities in my body, but they are sharing my karma, isn't it? Because when I will leave this body, all these living entities are going to leave this body also.
Some of them will start feasting, but that's okay. They won't live long after that. They will give off a bad odor.
How do you explain that? What is their karma?
Yeah, we've all, the Vedic literatures describe material energy as being 1/4 of the total creation of the Lord. But in reality, from our perspective and from our ability to perceive anything, material energy is really like unlimited. We can't really even see the borders of the universe that we live in. And so all of these crazy permutations is just like single drops of water being tossed around in the whole entire ocean. And so there's innumerable drops of water being tossed around in the ocean. And what drop of water is going to come in contact with what other drop of water at any given point in the 4.5 billion year history of our planet is like anybody's guess. But this appears systematic and planned because it is actually a function of your karma. So the people that we've met in our life, especially if we, in situations that are not like directly related to Krishna consciousness, and I realize that most of the people listening to this have been devotees practically their whole lives at this point, or for a very long time. But there have been times in my life when I wasn't a devotee. I wasn't born as a devotee. There were times when I've been wandering without devotee association in the material world. And that's karma. The people that I come in contact, it's their karma that they come in contact with me. It's my karma that I have to put up with them, right? Sorry, that was cynical again. But, this is just like driftwood coming together on a boat. It's the same thing even with our own families. Like, why am I the child of my parents? You know, that's my karma, you know, that I was born into that family. Why are they the children of their parents? And so this karma is acting on like the level of like gross material nature. I'm in this body, they're my parents in that body. But what is this body made up of? You know, there are all of the living entities in the body, you know, the DNA, the chemicals, the recycling of the chemicals through, as Prabhupada describes in a purport in the Bhagavad Gita, as well as some letters we were reading. We're just starting to study evolution in our biology class now, so I always like to see the word evolve favorably in Prabhupada's books, because it's often not taken that way. But Prabhupada explains that life began in water, right? Life began in water. And from water it arose and it turned into all of these other various messages. There's a letter that Prabhupada wrote to Bharad Raj Prabhu it was on October 16th, 1977. It wasn't a letter, it was a conversation that Prabhupada was having with Bharad Raj Prabhu in Vrindavan a month before Prabhupada left his body. And at that time, that was the first, Mother Mukhi also mentioned something about the BI this morning, that was during the first BI conference, the Life Comes From Life conference, which was held in Vrindavan right at the end of Prabhupada's Manifest Pastimes. And Prabhupada was instructing Bharad Raj about evolution in the mood of wanting Bharad Raj to make dioramas of how this all works. And he was explaining that life begins in water, and from there it evolves out into all of these other things, land animals, fish, land animals, animals on two legs, animals on four legs, trees, things that move, things that don't move, all this stuff. And we see this cycling through the rain, right? And this is what's explained in the Bhagavad Gita, that the living entities fall to the earth in rain. And if you gather rain and look at it under a microscope, you will see many living entities. We did this actually just yesterday. We just went to the pond water. We took water out of the pond. You look at it, it doesn't look like there's anything in there. You look at it under a microscope, there's hundreds of living entities in one drop of water. How did they get all in your body? You know, why is this one little of the Campbell soup can of bacteria, why are those the ones in my body? Yeah, that's their karma. And you can make it their good fortune, not you specifically, but we can make it their good fortune by treating them nicely, by feeding them Krishna Prasadam, you know, by letting them hear the kirtan. Because they don't hear the kirtan. Their sense of hearing is not developed enough to hear Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. But what we hear is that mantra is a vibration. It's a compressional wave. And they're getting it, you know. And so we should sing loudly for Krishna, even if we're terrible at it. One day. I think, let's take two more questions, then I gotta go. We got Mother Ragatmika and Mother Kashi, yeah.
Prabhu, did you say the Guru manifests in many ways? I was wondering, what were you thinking in that statement?
Prabhupada said the principle of the Guru is one. It's not like this Guru is gonna give me that, and that other Guru is gonna give me that, and you know, I go to different Gurus for different things. So the principle of the Guru is one. The Guru is the person who is lifting you out of material energy and cutting the knots that tie us here. That is the Guru. But it's not that one principle is the same person in this Guru's body versus that Guru's body. It's not like all of the various Gurus in the world are inhabited by the same life force. They're all their own individual living entities. But if they're a bona fide Guru, they're representing that principle. But the personality is important, you know, in finding the right personality for us to learn from. You know, it's very difficult to learn from a teacher that you don't like and respect, right? So there are differences.
Yeah. Another thing, I appreciate that distinction you made between our devotional bhakti process and the, what do you call that? Judeo-Christian religion.
Abrahamic. Yeah, because we don't want to leave out the Muslims.
That distinction of them aspiring simply to be saved. Interesting.
Yeah, I don't want to get into too much criticizing other religions, but there is a stage beyond being saved. There is a spiritual life beyond just being saved, and so that is what we are aspiring to.
And some in those Abrahamic religions, some are seriously pursuing beyond that. I think, like cloistered.
Sure. Yeah, there are also many examples. There are some very prominent examples of people within, especially Catholic monastic traditions,
Saints.
Having visions that are very much visions of Vrindavan. Yeah. You know, we'll go to Mother Vega and then Mother Ekadashi, and then I got to go play football with you.
The living entities in my brain are always happy to hear your classes because they get enlivened. But what you just came in my memory when you were talking about the living entities within may not be able to hear the mantra, but it's a vibration. So one time I was told that in Honolulu there was, maybe this was a Govinda's restaurant. So at one point there was a devotee working there who was deaf. And in the restaurant, sometimes they played Krishna conscious bhajans and like that, and sometimes they just played mood music that was gentle and mellow and so forth. So he was in there one day, and they had the mood music on. He was cleaning or something, and then it switched to bhajans, and he looked up at one of the devotees and he said,
"He likes that."
Pointing to his ear, he could tell the difference, but he couldn't hear it.
Yeah, for absolutely. I mean, if you go to, I mean, I've been to a lot of rock concerts in my life, some on big stages, and you see these like major, you know, rock stars, like people we all know and love or whatever, and there's somebody on the side of the stage. There's in one band that concerts I like to go to, they have a section on the side of the stage right in front of one of the main speakers that's cordoned off for deaf people. And they have a sign language interpreter standing there doing interpretive dance and signing the lyrics to the songs. And for sure, these people can feel the vibrations coming off that speaker. That's why they put them right in front of the speaker. So we are blessed as humans to have very evolved senses. You know, and that's what makes human life so unique, is that our senses have reached a stage of maturity that allows us to perceive things kind of, sort of, the way Krishna perceives things. But it's not that all of these other living entities are devoid of senses. They're just covered over. And so the example is given, sometimes it's covered over by dust on a mirror, sometimes it's covered over by smoke on a fire, which is less of a covering. Other times it's covered over by a baby in a womb, which is more of a covering. You can't see the baby in the womb. But how do we, this was actually the last point in my notes, so I'm glad I get to it here at the end. How do we detect that there is a baby in the womb, right? There's some, maybe some physical symptoms, but to confirm that those physical symptoms are pregnancy is that you hear the baby in the womb. The first symptom of another living entity impregnated is that you can hear their heartbeat. You can't see it, right? You can hear it. And how do we see the baby in the womb? We see the baby in the womb through sound, through ultrasound, right? So sound is the foundation of this universe. I'll just make this last point before we get to a comment. The reason why my schedule changes, I started teaching music this semester because a music teacher is taking a little bit of a sabbatical. And so the first thing we did in our music class is we read the first chapter of a book called The Silmarillion by J.R.R. Tolkien, which in the first chapter of this book, you saw this, he describes the creation of the material universe as the singing of empowered demigods manifest into form. And he does it in just the most beautiful poetic language. And that is, in fact, exactly the description that we see in the Bhagavatam, is that this universe is a manifestation of the singing of Lord Brahma with the help of other living entities. So sound is the foundation of our universe. The modern material scientists don't quite understand this. They think it's light. And most of what we know about the broader universe around us, we know from understanding light, but because we don't really understand the nature of subtle sound. All right, last point. Sorry, thank you.
Hare Krishna, thank you. You mentioned that there are qualifications for the speaker of the Bhagavatam. And so I just wondered, you know, outside of, I think, obviously following the four regulative principles, what would be the qualifications now for someone to speak the Bhagavatam?
That's the first one. Yeah, obviously. We need to be following the path of bhakti ourselves. But we also need to have heard properly from a proper authority. And that can be challenging. The proper authority needs to have the proper, because this is the parampara system, that the knowledge is handed down to us and we are transparent via media, is the phrase that Prabhupada would use, is that we are not injecting our own purports into the matter. We are taking the purport that is the siddhanta, that is the perfect conclusion of the guru parampara, and we're communicating it in a way that is appropriate to time, place, and circumstance, you know, that is appropriate to the qualifications of the hearers, which is a skill unto itself, but we're not changing it to suit the need. So, just to give like a really gross and hypothetical example, In the Bhagavad Gita, it's explained that there's no need for a sun or the moon in the spiritual world. There's no sun and moon. There's no need for it. And Prabhupada, not changing the Siddhanta, but communicating the Siddhanta in a way that, I guess I'm not giving a gross and hypothetical example. This is a very real example. He adds the word electricity into the verse. Right? He says there's no need for sun or moon or electricity. Right? So there was no electricity when Krishna did not say no electricity to Arjuna. They weren't using electricity then. Because electricity is actually a form of maya. Right? What do we need electricity for? I can't eat it. Right? There are people living on this planet for God knows how long without any electricity. Now we've got electricity. We think it makes our life easier. In fact, the production of the electricity over the last 200 or 300 years has created a lot of pollution, continues to create a lot of pollution, and we use the electricity for all kinds of other horrible things. And so to communicate that there's no electricity in the spiritual world is adapting the Siddhanta to our time, place, and circumstance. To say that, well, because now I live in a world where there's electricity, everything's fine and good and we should just use it indiscriminately for whatever we want, because it's here, that's changing the Siddhanta. And this becomes actually kind of a subtle thing. I didn't make the point that clearly. This becomes a subtle thing. We start to justify our activities based on the strength of something in the scripture, right? Or we do something and we find some scriptural passage to justify why it's okay to do that. I'm no longer a transparent vine medium. I've not adapted the Siddhanta to suit the time, place, and circumstance. I've changed the meaning of the Siddhanta to suit my own personal agenda. So we have to have heard from a qualified source, and being able to hear in and of itself is quite a skill, right? People generally, and this is also some Nirodha and the 12th canto, the age of deterioration, people's listening skills are just generally, like, terrible, right? Just, you know, and the internet isn't helping, right? So our attention, so one of the things that's described in the very beginning of the Bhagavatam, Manda Sumanda Matayo Manda Bhagya Yubadutra, Prayanupayusa Sabha, means that the duration of our lives are becoming shorter. And not only the duration of our lives, but all of our faculties are becoming diminished, including our ability to hear. So we have to have heard properly from a proper authority. I'll just make one last point about this. So a lot of times, you know, as a scientist and as somewhat of a public-facing scientist, I would field a lot of questions from YouTube researchers, you know, Googlers, the Google class out there who get onto the Google and do their research and think that now they have something to say about the field of geology I'm studying or talking about or whatever. And they may have done some research on the Google, and there's a lot of research, you know, there's a lot of bona fide knowledge in the internet. Like, you can go learn a lot about geology on the internet, even from a place like Wikipedia. You can learn a lot about geology. But in order to practice geology in a university or as a profession, or in order to teach it to somebody else, you really need to have learned it from a teacher. So if somebody had studied geology for 20 years on the internet and then wanted to go teach a college class about it, no way. They're going to want to know, where did you get your degree? Because where you got your degree is who you heard this from, right? And so it's the same thing with the Bhagavatam. You can go read the Bhagavatam online. It's all on there. All of Prabhupada's books, all of his purports, practically everything the man ever said in the later years of his life is available online for free, right? But if somebody were to study that by themselves for 20 years, would we let them come in here and give the Bhagavatam class? No, because you need to hear it in the association of devotees with the devotional mindset. That is a fact. We would not let them do that. So there's a process of cultivating devotional knowledge. Devotional knowledge has empiric aspects to it, and our acharyas did not reject empiricism as a way of developing knowledge in the world. And when I say empiricism, I mean observation, basically what the scientific method is. But ultimately, real transcendental knowledge is given to us by the mercy of the devotees, right? It's given to us. It's a descending process. It's revealed to us. And in order for it to be revealed to us, we need to be in the right place at the right time, right? Which means to stay in the association of devotees, because you never know when it's going to be revealed to you. But it is also revealed to us every morning at 7:20 and 4:30, right? Period. Here it is. It's all right here. Do we have the eyes to see it is the question. So, thank you very much. We'll do this again tomorrow. Okay, Hare Krishna.